Good morning.
Good morning.
Josiah wanted to join us this morning, so we're happy to have him here. It's been so long since I used a Zoom. I went to turn it on. It says, you've got to update before you can use this. So I don't quite have this as smoothly connected as I'd like, but hopefully we'll get the job done. Glad to see you all this morning, and as Brother Dan mentioned in his prayer, we're grateful for the sunshine, aren't we? So, the controls are a little bit different. Josiah, on this version of the program, if you find you're not getting anything, please text somebody you know and we'll do something about it. Very well. We've been reading in Luke, and again this morning, we'll continue there. Good to have Pastor with us this morning.
Yes. Thank you.
Chapter 6, we are still in. Now, one thing that hopefully I have successfully communicated to you is that Luke's account of these events seems to focus on the developing scenario that is occurring here with the apostles, disciples initially, becoming a crucial extension of the ministry of Jesus and his intent to adequately train them as soon as possible. And so I think it's important that as we read this, we think of that scenario, the need to bring these raw recruits into line and up to speed with the mission of Jesus. Now, we know probably from our own experience that that's actually a process, and it doesn't happen overnight. And so even in their case, we find many cases down the road where they weren't up to speed. They did need some help along the way. And that is the nature of things. However, it helps to understand how things are said if you know what the purpose is. And so I have found that helpful already in this chapter in the way that Jesus presents various teachings. And so verse 40, we aren't surprised to see this verse. He says, the disciple is not above his master, but everyone that is perfect shall be as his master. I think we did read that last week and talked about a bit. We're not talking about perfection in any sort of modern sense of infallibility or lacking any sort of continued maintenance. Pardon me? Anyway, it is more the concept of having reached a state of completion, a state of usefulness, and so the point here being, the disciple is always to place himself below the master. It's pretty important in terms of interpersonal relationships how we perceive ourselves. And it comes out in our attitudes, in our actions. If we are the one who is perceiving that we are in leadership, we are in control, then we take action that reflects that. If we think that we are in a superior place of knowledge, we'll probably express that in the course of conversation. And so how we view ourselves is very important. And with regard to Jesus as being the master, as being the Lord of our life, it should always be a mark of our lives that we hold him to be the master. We hold him to be the one listened to, the one followed. And so that should have been obvious. We was looking on from a distance. We look at the disciples and it's like things that Jesus was doing. Why wouldn't you always anticipate him as the leader, as the master, as the one who knows? And yet, we know from Scripture there were times whenever they felt like they knew better. They were tempted to take the lead, to suggest which direction to go from here. And so Jesus here, in trying to prepare their minds for their coming role, notes that if you have this kind of relationship, the objective is to be as the master and not above. So a pretty basic point.
Question.
Yes.
Just a question about the word perfect.
Yes.
I don't understand enough about grammar to know for sure if this is even a valid question, but the sense of complete, is it grammatically kind of an ongoing completeness? Because we don't get the sense that, throughout Scripture,
we
get to a place where we're just finished.
Right. So it doesn't. We can't derive that from it. It's used a lot in the New Testament to talk about things like fixing nets. So it's when it's fixed, when it's restored to its useful position, then it's as the master. So this is a statement which shows how high you can rise. You never get above the master. At the ultimate, at your greatest point of development, and if you think about it, if all your knowledge comes from the master, you're never going to exceed him.
I think the ESV is helpful. A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher.
As, right, so that the like as is the Greek expression there. I talked about the fact that there is development. We learn that from other places and life itself. The illustration here is if your route to wherever you're going is through a teacher, the most you can ever get from them is what they know, and you're not going to get above.
I noticed here in the possible meaning, I don't know where they get it, but I can kind of see it, that meaning perfectly trained says.
I think that was the translation that Laura read us.
Okay. Fully trained.
Fully trained, okay. Mm-hmm. Yes. But so.
Does that correspond to the word, the Greek word, or is that?
Okay, so language is flexible and complex and all that. We don't find a lot of uses of that express interpretation, so you wouldn't do that. But if you see that he's using it here and you see some of the other ways he's using it, then you say, okay, this is an extension of that idea to this area. So
So I don't know. Word is used in other ways or in other areas in what way?
So, for instance, when you're mending a net, if a net is torn or broken, it's in an unusable state, and it has to be mended. It has to be restored to its original intention. Oh, can you hear me or not?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
I suppose a perfectly trained student is one who's always in the mode of learning, of continuing.
The master would hope that, yes. Yeah. Yeah, that would. But you know, you can't derive everything from one verse or one word. If you think about what Jesus is doing here with his disciples, he's saying, pipe down here a little bit and listen. I'm the master. You're going to learn from me, and don't get ideas about running over top of me or beyond me. Now, in real life, when you talk about teachers and students, there's some other issues that come into play. For instance, in the world of music, there are issues besides knowledge. There's also potential, natural potential. And so I may teach you beginning music and get you going, but you may, even on your own, excel my ability to execute that because of natural capacity. But when you're talking about fundamental knowledge, you can't exceed your teacher, especially if they are the source of knowledge. You're not going to pass them. Okay. An important point of perspective for the disciples at this juncture in their life. Jesus continues, "Why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but perceivest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Either how canst thou say to thy brother, brother, let me pull out the mote that is in thine eye, when thou thyself beholdest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Thou hypocrite, cast out first the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to pull out the mote that is in thy brother's eye." So much is made about how perhaps outrageous this illustration might have seemed to Jesus' listeners. This picture of a timber, a beam, sticking out of one's eye, and then yet them being able to see a speck at the same time in somebody else's. What does this illustrate? It illustrates our capacity as human beings not to see ourselves as we really are. In terms of coming to where God wants us, this is a fundamental piece of information that we need to become aware of. I don't see myself like other people see me. I very well may not see myself as I am, and I need to. And whenever it really becomes manifest like this, where you're dealing with, you can see somebody else, it's so easy to see the other, it really reflects badly on you when you find cause to criticize them for a defect that you have in a much greater way. So this is an illustration of the extreme, but it fundamentally points to a human problem. It's a sobering thought and meant to cause us to examine ourselves. Jesus wants us to be aware of ourselves in this sense.
I find that fascinating that it comes after the disciple-teacher scenario, because if my mindset is, well, I got it figured out, you know, I'm going to be much more apt to, that thing in your eye, you know, versus, yeah, I'm a student, and I need to figure out who I am and how, I mean, that just, it's a very different mindset. And not that, you know, we don't try to understand ourselves and others and seek to help people and whatever, I mean, it's this nuance, but I can see how it does address a basic mindset.
And let's read a little bit more before we comment any more, because there's usually in Scripture a wider picture that it helps to start with getting the broad view of before we get too micro. And so he says, for a good tree bringeth not forth corrupt fruit. Okay, so corrupt, in this case, rotten. The word for good here, there's at least a couple words in Greek that are translated good. And it seems that scholars have always struggled to really find a major dividing point where this one's always this way and this one's always that way. There's a little bit of a tendency. The good here tends toward beautiful, toward good to look at, as opposed to good in character. But don't depend on that always being the case, because that those two words, it's kalos versus agathos. And agathos is used in verse 45 to talk about good. But in this one, it's the other one. And really, I don't think that's the point of the picture. The picture is pretty pretty straightforward. And he really explains his application in the next verse. He says, for every tree is known by its fruit. For of thorns men do not gather figs, nor of a bramble bush gather they grapes. So this idea that there is something in the very nature of a thing which anticipates its product. Okay? So there is a connection between the nature of a thing and what it produces. You just don't find figs on thorn bushes, because that's not the nature of thorn bushes. They don't do that. Or grapes on bramble bushes. There is, in the nature of things, a connection between a kind of tree and what it produces.
Keith, this also brings up the idea of care for plants, trees, grapes. They have to be tended regularly. You have to prune that in order to get good out of it, at least more good. And I'm guessing, because there's correct, excuse me, spoken of in the Bible, I think we've understood, excuse me, the idea of working with plants.
Yes, okay. yes, indeed. Sometimes Jesus makes use of those images. Gospel of John, he talks about that pruning process, that you'll bear more fruit. So not just that you bear fruit, but we can use the tree metaphor, the plant metaphor, to illustrate other things as well. But here, he's just pointing to the connection between there is a fundamental nature in things which produces predictable results. There is a connection. And he seems to apply it further in verse 45. He says, a good man out of the good treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is good. And an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is evil. For of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaketh.
This also makes me think about understanding ourselves. And if there is a problem in our lives, we don't just give up. We don't say, oh, well, I can't help myself. This is just the way I am. We dig deep and say, okay, there's this symptom. What's the cause of it? And we're going to get to the bottom of it. And not just pray about it, because prayer is a good thing, and that's a good start. But prayer by itself isn't usually enough to take care of the problems. Yeah. There has to be a plan. And a lot of times accountability is somebody that you trust and will help you walk the journey and say, I've got anger issues or whatever it is. I've got this problem now. I recognize it. I'm going to overcome it. I haven't yet. Please pray for me to help me. And these are the things I'm going to do. And can you think of anything that will help me to overcome this? And it's an introspective way of looking at, okay, this is our interaction with people and why it's so important that we interact with people and try to develop meaningful relationships and connections and attachments. Because it helps us to see ourselves in a way that we can't. At the whole point, I didn't see this when I was younger. It's just been the last few years that this has really stood out to me. Probably because of ourselves. And trying to connect with them and trying to understand them. And also understand myself. I approach life that I do have issues. I don't see them, but everybody else does around me. If everybody else does, I've got to have them. I'm not any better off, and my background's worse than I'm not with other people, and I carry baggage with me. And every once in a while, it comes out in relationships. It comes out and I say, oh my, that's not the way I want to be. That's not the desire of the heart. But there's something inside there. There's something deep within my soul that needs worked on. And I'm committed. I'm going to get to the bottom of it.
And this also redirects that, too. Instead of just, I have anger issues, so I'm going to not be angry. It's, God, what would it look like for me to be the kind of person who doesn't get angry inappropriately? And what would it take for me to become that kind of person? So it's a deeper level than just dealing with, you know, how do I hide my anger from people? Or, you know, how do I excuse it and say, well, that was a fluke. I don't normally do that. In fact, I never do that, except for when I do.
And that's human nature. That is human nature, to hide negative aspects. We're so good at deception with ourselves and other people that if there's a problem, oh, I won't do this in front of you. I'm sorry, you're offended. I'm going to modify my behavior to make myself look good, so you think better in my mind. But people are that stupid, and God certainly is.
And so, as we're reading Jesus saying these things, what might we say is his response to these problems? What is he advocating?
Learn from him. Trust him and learn from him.
Transformation?
Oh, yeah.
Is he not advocating that we change?
Yes.
And is he not advocating that we change our world by first changing ourselves? Mm-hmm. Now, if you understand that to be the mission of God through Jesus Christ, that changes how you understand everything. Because there's a lot of people that don't understand that. There are popular versions of Christianity which mandate that you accept your badness, but then resolve the situation by saying, well, don't worry, Jesus has taken care of that. That's not much of a solution. I don't think that was God's plan. And I don't think Jesus would talk like this if it were. He wants us to change.
And he gives us the tools. You know, I remember when I first realized that I was capable of deceiving myself. It was terrifying because, like, well, how will I ever know? Like, if I'm deceiving myself, that's like an endless cycle. And so it was really scary. He's like, I don't know if I can be honest now. But he says, you know, examine yourself. And here's how you'll know what comes out of you. That's how you know. And so it doesn't have to be terrifying. It's in those pressure moments what pops out. Well, that will tell me what I really am, not what I think I am. And as opposed to excusing it away, oh, thank you, Lord, for this opportunity to see what is real.
Yes, and there are so many tools that he gives us. That's certainly certainly one of them. That's a good way to think about it. And maybe that's how we should take this discussion for a little bit, thinking about the kind of tools that Jesus provides us here in this on this this occasion. But in order to understand the usefulness of the tools, you sort of first have to understand the nature of the problem. And we delineated part of it here by noting that as human beings, we are capable of self-deception. That's something Jesus wants us to know. You can lie to yourself. Ultimately, I suppose you could be in utter despair about recognizing that, as Julia described the initial contact with the idea and sort of the terror of it. But the way that you escape that is that you methodically uncover the truth of your own life. And, you know, there's various words that we use to talk about detailed experiences that don't adequately convey what's going on. For instance, we've already talked this morning about prayer. Prayer is a word which elicits all sorts of responses in people's minds. But one of the essential ingredients of prayer, as we have said before, is prayer is the act of placing yourself in the presence of God. And when you do that, if you really do it, that brings an honesty in your thinking that there's really no replacement for. It's just you, it's just Him, and you are accepting that He knows everything about you, what you think, what you want, what you've done, what you tried to do and didn't get done, the whole thing. And if in that act of placing yourself in His presence, you with open arms embrace His gaze and communicate with Him that you know He does care, but you need His help to truly change your life. That's an activity there's no replacement for. You can't put a time on it. It doesn't take a certain amount of time. You're not done, ever. But it often, in a lot of people's minds, is sidetracked by various images of, okay, prayer's about asking God for stuff. Prayer's about talking to God about people. Well, yes, it's those things too. Prayer is most importantly for you talking to God about you.
One thing you said there, truly believing a particular thing about Him, it's very important that we have a proper understanding of who He is. Because, you know, if I pray and I think He is excusing everything because Jesus has died and I'm covered, it's not going to accomplish the good in me that that He intends for it to, because I don't have an accurate picture of who He is. Isn't that true?
So, I'm sure it could be abused. Yes, you have to work to understand who you're talking to. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then, besides that, too, community helps to push back on the places where, you know, if we've made a false image of God, and so he's not, you know, we are able to, in our minds, restrict him from saying certain things to us.
Yes.
And that's where the community, you know, he approaches everything from two directions. He does a lot of stuff himself, and then he uses people a lot. And so, in our growth, it's important for us to spend direct time with him. And it's also, he's set it up so we encounter other people in such a way that it brings out
sure
blind spots that we might not see otherwise.
Sure, it does. Those are two very important things. So, in thinking about what God wants to accomplish among us, Jesus here wants to make us aware of ourselves. He wants to make us aware of our capacity for self-deception. He wants to make us aware of the true condition of our heart. And that's kind of a euphemistic way of talking about a complex thing. What's going on inside of you? You know, your desires, your ambitions, what it is you're trying to accomplish in life, what it is it takes to make you happy. What you want to see accomplished in other people's lives. It's a complex thing, and yet it all is connected. And so then, I'm trying not to sneeze.
what verse was that?
Okay. I learned when you're deer hunting, if you do this, you can sometimes keep from sneezing. It's the last thing you want to do when you're deer hunting, to scare the deer away, right? And when you're not deer hunting, you can't get rid of them. They're in your yard and in your garden and your flowers. The whole arena of understanding who I am and what in fact is the truth in the condition of my heart is important to Jesus. Now, some of the structures in our heart we don't naturally see as potentially bad. For instance, we tend to sort of construct a sacred concept associated with the word mine, M-I-N-E, mine. What is mine? And this starts at a pretty young age. We have a pretty good notion of what we appropriate as mine. And if it's mine, you have no right to it, ultimately. I may share it, I may choose to, I may not. But and then we build on that. You know, we expand the world of mine as far as we possibly can. We plan for it. We anticipate it. And the more intricately we impose our expectations on the future and on expanding mine, in fact, the more securely we ensure our imminent disappointment. That concept can never satisfy us. It can never really be totally preserved as mine. And so this is something that Jesus has already addressed really in this sermon in an interesting way. If we think about the net result of his admonitions up here, to love your enemies, to give to those who might not pay again, to bless those who curse you. Those are all admonitions which fly in the face of our natural sense of justice about what is mine and what is right for me. They leave us vulnerable in ways that are very uncomfortable. Now, we saw how that in his instructing his disciples in this way, so specifically in this instance, there's a bit of a unique thing here in that Jesus is present in their world. He is there. And there's no reason for them to consider exceptions like self-defense in the face of evil, because Jesus is there. He's going to take care of that. He's asking them to put everything in his hands. And so we'll not trouble ourselves right now with the world of exceptions and self-defense, recognizing that there is room for that as well. But thinking of this in terms of how he is dismantling the natural structures of the heart, which build walls around things that we consider sacred. And he really does poke holes in the things that normally we don't allow to be violated with some of this teaching.
It's helpful. This is where the kingdom language is helpful for me. Mine is very much a kingdom word, but it's my kingdom. As opposed to if I am surrendered to God, that it's his kingdom and this is his. You know, whatever I would consider mine then becomes his. So then that makes it easier to give things away, and also harder in a way, because we are to be good stewards. So you don't just go handing out stuff that's not yours if you're going to give an account for how you handled it.
Yes. This is something that, in retrospect, as you've lived your life and you look back, it's not nearly as big a struggle as it is when you're going through it. You know, if we were to imagine for a moment a young person living 3,000-4,000 years ago, perhaps in the Holy Land, and the life that they live, and the anticipation of life that they face, and the things that the desires that they want. What would you want in a world like that? Maybe a sheep of your own? I don't know. Maybe a bow? Maybe whatever? And we look at all that now, you know, they're dead and gone and turned to dust many times over, so to speak. And all those desires which drove them to perhaps even cruelty against others are like nothing. And yet in the experience of life, when we find ourselves in an analogous position, those issues can be the most important things in our mind. This is what matters to me. I have to achieve this. I have to acquire this. I have to experience this, or else I'll somehow not be happy. And Jesus calls us to himself. He calls us to trust him with what is truly good wherever we find ourselves in life. And that's the issue.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's striking. I'm just thinking about how even things that we consider, maybe this is what you mean by sacred. So good things, you know, it's good for us to have families and to have children and to promote disciples of Christ or whatever, but those things can all become about mine and me finding my fulfillment or what I desire fulfilled as best I can, rather than giving those two to God and finding my fulfillment in him personally. And it all turns to ashes in your hands when you do that. I mean, we see it everywhere in the world, you know, relationships. If that's the God, if that's the sacred, and that's going to satisfy me, you know, it doesn't. But even good things can become.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they certainly can. And you really need to ask yourself at various times in your life, what if the thing that I want most of all doesn't happen? What then? Does that change God? Does that change His goodness? Does that change my importance in His eternal scheme of things? And you really have to say no. It doesn't. It really doesn't. It's hard to say at various times in your life. And we see that struggle, of course, in the very young. They get their sights set on some objective that they want to achieve. You see it in the grocery store and Walmart all the time, right? I want that. And if I don't have that, I will be eternally disappointed. Let me just show you how disappointed I'll be. That's us. That's humanity. That's human beings. And so Jesus calls us to recognize where we're at, what it is that we approve of, what it is we consider sacred, what it is we protect at all costs. Yes.
Before we go on here, I just, in my mind, I don't have this all sorted out, and it may be inappropriate to think of this in these things kind of together, but in light of being easily distracted and being sidetracked of things that are of most importance, and are not being distracted by what I want if I don't get this, whatever the ultimate desire that I have in this world right now, if I don't get that, so I'm just thinking about that, and then thinking also that we are eternal beings, and there are, and maybe this is an inappropriate understanding on my part, but there are things that we can do in this life that do have, that can have eternal consequences as well. Mm-hmm. And thinking of how we interact with others and can influence others for Christ.
Yes.
That can have, you know. So would you be able to speak to how do we balance being industrious and thinking industriously in this world and where we are now, but filtering through the things that don't really matter, but the things that we can do here and now that can matter and that do matter and that can carry some weight eternally, and put some value on that.
Yes.
You know, of course, we, you know, seeking God and how He would have us to live and all that. Anyway, that's sort of it's a little bit muddy, maybe a little bit.
No, that's good. So, think about some of the things that Jesus has already said in this chapter. He talks about being merciful, for God is merciful. He talks about being able to supply the needs of those who don't have the means in life. And so, part of the mindset that Christ calls us to is a mindset of others' consciousness. And if you're going to be of a assistance in this world, you have to have means of assistance in this world. God doesn't give you 10 talents right off the bat in terms of money, for instance, and that's often at the core of our means of assistance in this world, having the resources, having the infrastructure, having the mechanisms in place to be of help. And so that inspires us to be industrious, not as an end within itself. You're not going to take it with you in the sense of the actual money or the goods or the houses or the lands or any of the other infrastructure. But being able to help people in need is a huge motivation to be able to have excess to share. So I don't know if that addresses what you were concerned with. Jesus talks about laying up treasures in heaven. I don't think it's productive to get into this whole rewards mentality of trying to... I'm not wanting more than you got when I get there. I mean, the very attitude of Christianity isn't compatible with that. I don't want to be a high-ranking official in heaven. I don't think there really is such a thing. I seriously doubt it. You've got God, and that takes care of just about everything you need right there. And so I don't even let that cross my mind, that I'm doing this because I want a bigger crown when I get there.
Two things that I'm thinking about. So what Dan said, it seems to me maybe what he's getting at, you answered, and I think I would take what you said and say, all right, so yes, I am doing, I want to find out how I can be productive so that I have assets to pour into the lives of others who need it. But because of my human nature, I have to keep a check on, you know, I have to watch how I interact with others, and I have to say, okay, now is this still about God and what he wants done? Because, you know, at any point, I mean, I know, and I'm going to go back to the second thing I was thinking about, how as I've had to die to certain things in my life and surrender them to the Lord, it seems like every time it brings me to my knees to help others. It's like he uses it somehow to help others. Mm-hmm. And there's a sweet, sweet surrender. There's joy. It's not like some death sentence. It's much better comes out of it. But then I have to always, even in that surrender and in actively trying to do what he has put in front of me, I have to think about, why are you doing this? Because you can kind of start grappling for, oh, this is fulfilling, or this is, no, it's not about you. This is about doing the will of God in this moment with what he has in front of me, pouring into others for their good, and I will be taken care of. He's got my back. I don't have to try to claw for myself. I don't know,
but just... Mm-hmm. Thank you. So, Jesus doesn't lay all this out as a point 1, 2, 3, 4. But once you start getting into the heart of what he's saying, you can go back over the same stuff and say, oh, there's connections here that I didn't think about the first time. You know, when he... This call to mercy, this call to service, this call to lack of grasping onto things of this world, those are directly connected to the kind of heart he wants you to have. It's not this law that you have to say, okay, I did that, and so I must be good to go. That's a totally different mindset. It produces a totally different kind of heart than the heart which says, I want to give because I've been given so much. And it's the heart that God is wanting to produce in us. It's a heart like his own. It's a heart like the heart of Jesus.
That reminds me also, it's human nature to try to come up with formulas and boxes. People have formulas for how to come to Jesus. It amuses me because I say this jokingly, not disrespectfully, but how did Jesus lead people to himself without those formulas that he had created yet? But that's how people are. Mm-hmm. It's as if we as humans want to put limits on God and try to put him in a box as to how he is supposed to respond and interact and be. There's a whole lot more.
Yep. It's that whole thing that you see sometimes illustrated in a young rebel in life. But you said, right? So whatever the issue is, I'm justifying myself because you said, and the actual words that you used, I can find a way to use to my benefit. a way which totally violates your intention, but you said, right?
That's, they use the words of Jesus like that.
Yeah.
Right, because you can't cover everything. You know, you have to trust people to think and apply, and even what we were talking about and connecting that with what Bruce said as far as like being industrious in your resources. Well, that's not just about money. It's like, what am I developing into that can be of service to the people around me? And it's just like every part of your life. It's, you keep your home, or you help yourself, or you know, whatever.
Or you build a road that people can drive on.
Yes.
You know, the things that make life work, all the infrastructure we often take so for granted, can be so beneficial to those who come after us.
It's hard to deal with people who have that type of mentality. I remember when I was teaching high school, I remember telling students that had that kind of a mentality in order to place blame on their lack of learning on me, the lack of work and diligence. I told them, if you care as much about learning as much as I care about teaching, there would be a problem. And I later applied that to my sons because they had that kind of a mentality. So I told them, guys, if you care about this relationship as much as I care about it, we would be getting all of heaven because I'll do whatever I need to have a great relationship with you. That's on you. I kept that the responsibility on them for their part. But that's how God is. He's doing all he can to have a good relationship with us. It comes back to us. What are we going to do? That's our opportunity.
Well, there's one more thing I'd like to point out this morning about this passage. And that is that Jesus gives no indication that I can find that those to whom he is speaking might not be able to do what he asks. If you can find that in there, I'd like for you to tell me and show me. But the whole manner and tenor and tone of the conversation presumes that these are things you're capable of. I'm asking you to do this because you're capable of doing this. And that's an important point of perspective.
I think it's part of the relationship, too. Instead of just a one and done, okay, you said this, that's nice. But what did Jesus mean by this? And to actually struggle with it, maybe for years, maybe for a lifetime. What does this mean? And how do I apply it to my life? That's a part of the relationship. Just as there's a struggle, not a bad struggle, but a struggle in relationships, you know, trying to get along and trying to find oneness. We don't have to give up because we don't get it the first time. We just keep at it.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Keith, this is also echoing something I heard this week, and it's something I've heard further back. So I heard Dennis Prager this week say something that he grew up hearing all the time in Jewish school, and it's something that I've also heard from G.K. Chesterton. And now we're seeing it here. My biggest problem is me. If we're worried about, well, how's this next election going to go, that's what we really need. You know, life would be better if this... Like, yeah, that's important, but my biggest issue is me. If I focus on that, then my focus is not focused on myself, but focused on transforming myself into the likeness of becoming like the Master. That's going to take care of the most problems in my life.
And what a world it would be if everybody did that.
Yes.
So, I don't know if you remember, but one of the first things we noted was Jesus calls us to change our world by changing ourselves.
Mm-hmm. His statement in the 42nd verse.
Yes.
Where Jesus says, cast out first the being out of thy own mind. How do we do that?
Well, you first have to recognize it. If you can't see it, you can't do it.
He's telling us to do that. Looks to me like.
Yes, I mean, in the line of the metaphor that he's using, if you can't see clearly because of what's in your eye, you have to take that out first. So you don't want to go too far creating theology from metaphors which have a specific purpose. But
more addressing our responsibility. He's not really talking about the fact that he cares and will help.
Right. But anyway, Jesus was a powerful teacher, and more than that, he will be Lord of your life if you will let him. Well, they haven't rung the doorbell yet, have they?
Well, that would be probably our responsibility.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, if the proper people will do that, that'd be great.
Thank you.